Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel, joined as always by my co-host Dave here, and I wanted to begin with sport.
Right.
Our producer, Liam, just told me an interesting fact. IBM's AI bested the StarCraft II Grandmaster.
Ah, now this is the kind of spot I can get on board with.
And then I understood that because we talked about Zergling rushes, and then Liam started talking about quantum qubits, and I checked out.
Quantum qubits, right.
Yeah,
you there? That true? So like the very best StarCraft player was beaten by an AI?
Apparently.
That's amazing.
And apparently, as Liam says, they were restricted.
What factions were being played?
I have no idea. Oh. Well, he said there was a Zergling rush.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we've just basically gone back to about, 2003 here?
I was never really into
it. I was actually going to raise...
I was into Warcraft 2 as well. And 3, yeah.
Oh, I was actually going to raise more important sport with you.
Yeah.
The All Blacks lost, and you didn't send me a message.
Yeah.
You didn't send me flowers.
Well, I think the Lord sent you a message.
You gave me, there was no hugs.
Yeah.
No hugs, no condolences, nothing.
No.
In fact, you had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who beat them?
It was England.
Yep.
And it was one of the most awful experiences, traumatic for my country that has ever been.
I did see, did I see an article saying that they did something different in response to the haka?
Yes.
Did they stand on a V or something like that?
They did.
Ah. As their power play?
They did.
See, look, I'm down with the sport.
It was a giant power pose. Well done. You are down with the sports. Yeah. See, this is you, if you're a regular listener, you'd know that this is a point of...
Contestation.
Disagreement between David and I.
We finally did it, people.
Yeah.
We've done a segue.
We're number one.
We are beginning a little series of episodes that are all around the idea of contestation and disagreement. This is kind of coming out of actually quite a few years of frustration for me. Noticing a lack of deep reflection about the nature of disagreement in a political community coming from all sorts of different corners, but especially I think in the church, especially kind of public theological figures, misunderstanding what I think of as the nature of a political community. In particular, there seems to be an overriding assumption that politics has kind of no substantive ends. Politics is just a matter of procedure. That adjudicates between competing rights claims or provides the rules of the game, so to speak, for disagreement, with the kind of political process being aimed at securing the resources necessary for the individual to be freed up to pursue their own kind of individual notion of an authentic existence. Now, I think... from a theological perspective, but also all sorts of other political philosophical perspectives, I think this is an insufficient understanding of the state, both in terms of theoretical coherence, but also on as a matter of practice as well. So we thought it might be a good time to start kind of laying out what we think of as the nature of contestation and argument and pursuit of a common good in a political community. And this was all kind of spurred on by a few different events in the public sphere that I think we'll be focusing on individually over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, so we're going to have an episode looking at questions around disagreement and friendship. We're going to look at an episode around disagreement in the church. But right now we're going to take more higher... level overlay to see where we go. And I think maybe we may contradict ourselves as we go through these different episodes, but hopefully not. So the question I want to begin with here is, can we hope for and seek to see a good society, a society that is of virtue, oriented towards common ends, in the face of pluralism.
So pluralism being
different conceptions of the good, disagreement over what it is to live a good life, right? Seen often typically referred to in terms of having religious difference, right?
So or multiculturalism.
Multicultural differences. Now, this is a question I think that gets leveled, has been in fact leveled at us, not leveled, that makes it sound like a giant accusation, but been put to us online at times. You know, when I talk often about seeking the common good and people say, but we disagree over this.
Yes.
Or I talk-
Who's justice, which rationality?
Yeah. Or if I talk about the exercise of civil authority being under an exhortation from the church. And then people say, well, what do you do about disagreement and pluralism and so on? So how can we try and instantiate something good together when we disagree? Is it possible to have a thick understanding of what is good for individuals in society while still in some ways respecting difference? Now, this comes up for me, and it comes up in numerous contexts, but it came up again when I was reflecting on James Davison Hunter and thinking about how his views are quite similar to Nicholas Walterstorff. Now, what you have there is they criticize an understanding that you'd see classically in someone like Aquinas, right, where the king's purpose was to secure the good life for the community. They were to cultivate virtue, to exhort people and encourage persons towards a life that is completed in the love of God and love of neighbor, right, and we're to live justly in light of that. And the king's purpose was to, in fact, be part of that economy. Now, Hunter and Walterstorff, their arguments are against this in critical ways. So Hunter, for example, he criticizes those typically what he describes as sort of left Christians who appeal to the Hebrew prophets, you know, let justice fall like the waterfall sort of thing, because he says those Hebrew prophets, they lived in a theocracy, whereas we live in a plural secular state, and so we can't seek to instantiate this understanding of justice in that quite that same manner. And so we can only then become faithfully present as one community amongst others. And Walterstorff is critical in his book, The Mighty and the Almighty, he's critical of this view of temporal authority, civil authority being used to cultivate virtue because he thinks it has no boundaries. You could start imposing obligations upon any person in any sphere of their life. And he says as well, it doesn't allow for the freedom of non-Christians, he says, because in his view, you, in a Christian understanding, you can't be virtuous unless you're pursuing the right religion. And so if they're not, then they are somehow outside of the, or they should be exhorted to come within the right ends of religion by civil authority. And he says that's contrary to what he calls the excellence of freedom, which he says must be supported by what he then calls the mechanical state. Now, he means mechanical as in the purpose of the state is simply to be rights protecting. So there you've got two thinkers who have a sociological and theological support. They give theological support to a liberal state. And by that, I mean a state that tries to exhibit a sort of equal concern and equal respect for different persons and their conceptions of the good.
Right.
And does so by itself claiming to be neutral as to the good, what is the good life. So it protects individual liberty for the sake of its own end. So the end, the purpose is, as Walter still put it, protecting the excellence of freedom. That may, of course, lead you to join with others in civil society groups, but that's quite different from politics itself, which is not, as Aquinas would have had it, trying to instantiate, trying to further a common good, a life together that is good for the individual and society itself.
So are both of these visions, so Hunter and Walterstorff, would they both be kind of proceduralist in nature? So basically politics is a matter of the procedures that secure the necessary space.
That's where it ends up.
Yeah.
That's where it ends up because, as he says, Walterstorff himself, it's a mechanical state. So it's not a state. It's not a civil community that is engaged in, St. Augustine would call it a res publica, you know, the common orientation towards a common love, trying to think through together and discern what it means to love God and love neighbor for the sake of God in all areas of life. But in fact, for Walterstorff, it becomes, you know, mutual protection of each other's privacy, mutual protection of each other's other's speech. Now, he includes within that mutual protection of each other's religious liberty, which allows people to form associations and so on.
Right.
But it's against the notion, is explicitly against the notion that our authorities should be trying to seek what is right.
Mm.
So he is writing in contrast to a thinker like Oliver O'Donovan, John Milbank, Alistair MacIntyre, where they say that there is the more classical view, and they're into, you know, still thinking to this day.
American, is he?
He's American. So in fact, no, that's this is the interesting thing. He in fact says that Paul, when he writes in Romans 13 about obeying the authorities, that Paul is actually saying that we are because the authority is rights protecting. And he says that's what Paul says. And he in fact writes in The Almighty and the Mighty, he says, now this turns Paul into a proto-American. And he says, so be it, explicitly. Right. Explicitly.
I mean, there's something in that though. Like Paul does appeal to rights and his rights as a citizen and things like that.
Oh, but that's very different. But it's very different because what you're dealing with there is what MacIntyre and others would say. Those are rights, inverted commas, that have been created by civil law.
Yeah.
Right. They've been actually, so I have citizen rights as I do in this country. Mm. Right. Now, that's a very different understanding to rights being the subjective rights, the things that inhere to me as an individual because I am an individual, right? That are natural in the sense that they exist outside of any actual allocation for right distribution purposes. Yeah, so anyway, so they have this procedural notion, as you're saying, right? Mechanical understanding of the state. Now they raise this for reasons of pluralism. Right, in part, that's one of the reasons you can't have this thick Christian understanding of the civil community because there is plural difference.
Mm.
Now, I have various problems with this. As someone who probably, if you're listening to this podcast, is someone who always talks about how we need to think together about what is our common good as a society. I have problems. Once a friend referred to criticisms of liberalism having an aesthetic quality. Mm. Right. And I thought, actually, that's got something to it. Mm. I would put it in my own thinking, sometimes thinking that these arguments put forward by, say, Walter Stauff and Hunter here and others like them saying this, they're too grim.
Yep.
They ultimately, in my mind, they're kind of lacking in hope.
Yeah.
Because they think that this is the best we can do. Now, there's something right in that, perhaps sometimes right.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about modus vivendi, or they talk about you know, almost agreement to disagree, or they talk about, like John Onazu has his book Confident Pluralism, we'll talk about a mutual non-aggression pact.
Yep.
Now, in part, you could think, that's not a bad thing, right? Yeah. The fact that we're not at each other's throats.
Yeah, that's right.
That can be a good thing.
Yeah.
But that's almost where it stops, and it stops for different reasons. But one is that they some writers will say it's because we're ultimately always locked in incommensurable clashes.
Yeah.
Right? So there's always irremediable differences between us.
And I mean, and we've talked about this. We've started talking about this a little bit, but I think where I suppose want to be critical is that I think I'm less hopeful than you. I'm less hopeful that agreement can be arrived at on these issues. But my desire to critique kind of a proceduralist liberal kind of order is that I think that liberalism smuggles in substantive claims about the nature of human life and flourishing. That go unquestioned and are unquestionable. But not only that, but they become the impetus for all sorts of kind of violent interventions because we have this kind of, enlightened universal subjectivity, this kind of Cartesian self-justifying universal identity. And those that don't, need to be brought into the Enlightenment, and we'll do this through wars of intervention. We'll do this through kind of cultural imperialism. We'll do this through the imposition of alien rights discourse onto other cultures and things like that.
Okay, so this is the second point. So one point is about whether I think it's hopeful, but the other one is about actually, yes, this imposes its own ends.
Yes.
It's not neutral in the way the mechanical state that, say, Walter Stauff puts forward is presenting itself. So it is clear, for example, that it purports an understanding of the primacy of an individual pursuing their authentic expression of themselves or their own conception of the good, or what some people will talk about as their ultimate commitments or otherwise talk about as their deep concerns.
Yeah.
And it's in that sense, it actually becomes, even though Walterstorff and these people say you can't have, you know, the imposition of religion, as it were, at the center of power, it becomes its own imposition of a type of religion that is genealogically connected to.
That's right.
And understanding that the purpose of religion is to find what is authentic to myself.
And then I think the then thinking back to our last episode, consumerism steps into that moral gap and provides the teleology. So it's not that we all of a sudden are freed from the imposition of external values and goods from outside of the self by liberalism. No, we're kind of, there's this kind of epistemological empty space, and then the market comes in and forms our desires for us. It tells us what kinds of things are worth pursuing. So I'm just very skeptical of this salvific narrative of liberalism.
Yeah, and then what you get as well is at its heart, because if you have these multiple clashing, what Tennyson called a wilderness of single instances, right, then what you have to have is a state that manages that. And that can become, and some people are explicit about this, agonistic, as in it's like a war takes place between these incommensurable differences. Or as you are putting it forward, you know, actually what you can also get is it just gets captured by different corporate interests, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, that idea there is that you have this sort of perpetual almost conversation of people just sort of pursuing their self-interest in a way that can be framed as rights talk, right?
Yeah.
So, one person asserts their rights against another. And you get it even in the context of then thinking about different religious organizations. They themselves now are just simply the aggregate of individual interests, and so they must be subject to claims outside of themselves and so on. So you have sort of, I guess, there's then three points there. One is that you have a sort of absence of hopefulness that you can have any end other than mere clash at the center. In fact, some people try and argue you should have this clash continuing on so that you never get any one party grabs all the power. Secondly, it does purport to have its own end, right? Namely, the pursuit of some conception of individual freedom. And then thirdly, that conception of individual freedom can then be actually imposed upon, as you mentioned, other religious groups. And then that raises the question we started with as to how does this actually support plural differences?
So you can understand this I suppose wanting to go back to the kind of case for pluralism, you can kind of understand where people are coming from when they fear objective assertions of objective goods that a body politic ought to be pursuing or that an individual life ought to be pursuing. So I think back to Hannah Arendt's discussion of ideology in the 20th century. So her hero, the hero of her story is Socrates, who, which is, she distinguishes Socrates from Plato in a way that, you know, you're taught in undergraduate not to, because there's only the Socratic Plato. But nonetheless, she sees Socrates as someone who believed that truth was arrived at through discourse, discussion and disagreement, that together people would come together and in conversation, in dialogue, the truth would be arrived at. And she distinguishes this from Plato, who sees truth as something that can be kind of grabbed out of the heavens and brought down to the earth by the great philosopher king. And she sees in that Platonic move the kind of proto-totalitarian who has a very solid notion about the nature of history, or the history as a process of the emancipation of a particular group or the ascendancy of a particular group, which because that idea is unquestionable and indubitable, it seeks to quash all other dissenting voices because of that. And so she wants to return to this kind of Socratic dialectical discursive way of approaching truth. But I think the thing that I find interesting about her that separates her from, say, just a mere bourgeois liberalism or a proceduralism is that she insists on the necessity of a common culture that provides the horizon of meaning in which the conversation takes place. So there's a shared assumption of, so she would be in favor of things like a canon of great cultural artifacts and things like that.
See, I think maybe you'd say something like that Platonic conception, if you take it in a Christian vein, could never be entirely just about you draw something down from the heavens, right? Mm. Because we think of it as Christianity has much more of a mediated conception to it, you know, through an incarnation, through an understanding of that we reflect on God through the things around us.
And the capacity for like the prophetic.
Yeah, but and even revelation being like heightened reason, right? It's not just a clear prescription handed down, right? That is just there on the page, do as it says. You still have to engage in forms of discursive understanding. But then that would lead me to say, well, okay, so if I follow on from what you're saying, my conception then when I'd say you can seek the common good, you can seek what is a just society, while then having the question raised of how do we respect difference and so on, partly because it's not just an imposition of a blueprint, but actually I would frame it more like an open teleology,
right,
in which you have to understand that practical reasoning still must take place, and that takes place in the context, say, of education, of welfare provision, of you know, care for the environment, of thinking about workplace relations and so on, all those things in which we live, in which you have to engage in a kind of noisy argument over what is our common good with respect to these different things. And then, so there's that, right? It is not just, you know, some imposition downward. But at the same, and also I think because there's this image that Pope Francis gives. He talks about society being a polyhedron rather than a sphere. Now, a polyhedron, of course, has multiple planes that nevertheless make up a rougher unity. A sphere is sort of, you know, every point is equidistant from each other and it's all smooth, it's all the same. The point he's making there is similar to, I think, what I was just saying earlier. It makes me sound like, you know, Pope Francis is quoting me. No.
He likes to riff on you a bit, doesn't he? Yeah.
So what I was saying before, right, is that when you have a liberal conception of our ends, namely to further conceptions of individual freedom, you understand, say, a religious group as simply an aggregation of interests.
Yep.
That means, for example, that, and this happens at law, you can get these sorts of questions, that when somebody outside of the group wants to enter in but presents a difference, the law must try and balance the two things. And sometimes the individual wins out over the group, for example, right? So we have cases that are about a Catholic music director who wants to have multiple relationships.
Yep.
And, you know, the court says, well, you've got to balance his self-determination, Catholic parish, right? In which case you got this understanding that people get to be Catholic how they choose.
Yep.
Right. So there's a kind of everything in the wash is a balancing of these individual interests, which may mean that you have to take account of interests that are somewhat foreign to how the group understands itself. Right. Now that's what he means by society as a sphere. Everybody must cohere in the same way. And the cohering is to a rule that is about individual self-determination, for example, something like that. Whereas what he says is you can have a society that is a polyhedron in which we have a certain unity because we all are seeking, you know, a good of education, a good of workplace, the dignity of labor, things like this. But at the same time, people can do so with some difference.
Yep.
Right? So I don't agree entirely with if a Muslim and a Christian sit down, they're not going to entirely agree on matters theological and so on. But they can actually comprehend one another in their, you know, sort of mutual pursuit of something that they both understand is in fact real.
Yes.
Right? And that's quite a different understanding, I think, because actually it's rooted in the idea that there is a goal.
Yeah.
There is an end that we're seeking. And then we think about how to accommodate
and it makes demands on us. So that I think that's one of the things that say a Muslim and a Christian bring together in understanding is this isn't a matter of my arbitrary choice, that I'm existentially kind of compelled to obey the tenets of my religion in a particular way. And then we can begin to talk about the implications of that for our common life.
Yeah, I mean, if I put it in a concrete context, so something like if we're talking at the really where the rubber hits the road about, you know, we're enforcing a, you know, Christian conception of something in society, and then what do you do about pluralism?
Yep.
So something like prayers in Parliament, right? So our Commonwealth Parliament opens with its sessions with the Lord's Prayer. And one argument against this is that, oh, it's contrary to multiculturalism, it's contrary to religious difference and so on. you know, and you often get liberal authors will appeal to religious difference at this point to say that they don't think it should be there. And yet my suspicion would be if you talked to the groups that you're using for your argument and said, what is your opinion of having the Lord's Prayer in Parliament? Mm. There would be a similar point to what is often said in the context of establishment in the Church of England in the UK, in England rather, namely that this places at the centre of a political life some conception that there
of
is
the transcendent.
A transcendent to be accountable to that is beyond simply self-interest or beyond merely the quotidian of politics and so on. And that to remove that would in fact be problematic not just for Christians, but would be problematic for an understanding of religion as a good at the heart and part of our society.
Yeah. No, and I think I've had that exact conversation with people of different faiths. But it is these moments where you're reminded in that that there are still pointers towards the transcendent in the culture. All those good things.
And so
in the same way that when I was just thinking about this, I was in a meeting at my work and someone knocked on the door and asked whether there was a prayer room, someone of the Muslim faith. And in that moment, I went, it actually kind of elevated me because it was a reminder that in my usually very, very secular day-to-day existence, that there were people pursuing God, even though it's a different conception of God to my own. Nonetheless, it's a reminder. And I often feel the same when I see people wearing religious garb in the public as well, even if they're not members of my religion.
Yeah. But I think this is a certain perhaps paradox probably a paradox, right, in which actually explicitly understanding as a community that you are trying to seek a common good. And by that, I do include, when I think about this, I think about true religion. But when I say that, I mean something like the love of God and neighbor, right? And having that as actually an aim of the community and thinking then about, and that very noisy argument kind of way, what does that look like? But actually having that there paradoxically is supportive towards pluralism because it actually has an element of respecting difference.
Yep.
Because you can understand this person is no longer just simply a rights-bearing individual seeking out their own conception of the good, trying to pursue what Walter Stoff called the excellence of freedom and coming into conflict, incommensurable conflict with other people who are seeking their excellence of freedom. But you can understand them as actually also engaged in common projects that are part of building a common life together.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yes. So what, and this raises a question that I think we'll get back to in a couple of weeks, but what do you do when you exist in a church environment that doesn't recognize that particular good, that sees itself as just another particular interest group within society, or at worst, an aggregation of individuals in some sort of voluntary association? Because my problem with this beautiful image that you're giving is that I don't think my religious context recognizes this pursuit or this image of what it means to be religious, that is to seek true love of neighbor and God. Instead, it would be some sort of, something. I'm probably going too far into something.
Well, I think you're thinking something like, if I understand, you're also saying something like, there's a way in which if you take a view like Nicholas Waltersdorf and these others I've just mentioned, you can actually create a church practice that just baptizes that.
Yes. So it becomes almost, funnily enough, a state religion of this agonistic liberal order.
Yeah, we're just one interest group amongst others pursuing our excellence of freedom.
Yes, and that leads
to the proposition, the possibility that you see explicitly raised now that, for example, you can't choose your leaders based on, say, religious doctrine, or you can't choose your educators based on this and so on. Because, in fact, just like any other organization that has a public orientation at least, you are subject to the uniform standard of the claim rights of individuals towards that, again, I keep using the phrase, but the excellence of freedom.
And there's a progressive version of this, like a religious progressive equivalent position, which sees, basically the whole aim of the Christian movement is to forswear power. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, it turns itself into just some outlier interest group that is part of the agonistic process. And in doing so, it actually sanctifies or enshrines this agonistic public sphere of competing individuals.
And it has to
be might be benevolent and seeking particular the good of, you know, minority groups or disadvantaged people.
But I also find it deeply ironic when that is thrown out there as a possibility, because usually speaking, you know, I joke with Kate all the time about, you know, various people are very invested in activist movements and social justice and so on. And great, I'm all in favor of it. But I joke with Kate about how they continually talk about themselves as operating at the margins of power.
Mm.
And yet these are the same people who are constantly lobbying for politicians to act in certain ways.
Yeah.
I don't understand what you think you're doing other than the traditional Christian notion of exhorting the exercise of civil authority in a particular direction, right? Now, that becomes fractured because we live in these different denominational spheres and so on, but you're still doing the, you know, and so when you say about exercising power, I'm not talking about, you know, we have a coercive state that compels people to the faith.
Yeah.
I'm not even talking about, you know, you see with some integralist Catholic thinkers now, they do perhaps suggest that in the Catholic context, the state, the civil authority could be used to compel Catholics to be, to adhere to their vows, right, their obligations. But I am talking about that there is always at the center, you know, some regulative feature, some understanding of what the good life is. And at the moment, or at least I don't think it's always present, but a lot of people think of it as, you know, what is the conception of the good life? It is to pursue one's self-determination, one's authenticity, one's ultimate concerns, one's conception of the good and so on and so forth, right? You know, there is a certain, Augustine would call it, at root a certain self-love, I think. So there is always something there. And the question is, what should it be? And when I say true religion, so I mean like dignity of labor practices. I mean the education as being elevation towards understanding one's purposes and community in relationship to God. I mean care for our common home in the way that Pope Francis writes of it in Laudato Si, right? These are all things that are manifestations of love of God and love of neighbor that are about, you know, what it means to exercise civil authority.
And so if we return to, just to finish up, if we return to this basic question that's been raised for us, I think Nathan Campbell raised this with us a couple of times, what do you do when these when there's contestation about what the nature of these goods are? So is the answer then just better public Christianity?
Better public, yes, and politics. As in politics is the mutual discerning of the common good.
Yeah.
In a noisy argument. And then when you're discerning that, you have a question. What do you do about difference? How do you respect it? When can you respect it? And I think you can. In many instances you can, because you see it as, although different, a way of also participating in that pursuit of a common good.
Yeah. And I imagine also better Christian education as well.
Oh, you're asking me now, how do I,
when I was asking about what should we talk about, someone was like, can you talk about some actual praxis?
I disagree with it. That was Victor. I disagree because, you know, we actually talk about various things that people should do all the time, I think. And I think sometimes the idea of, oh, can you give that, it's because there's a certain kind of... you know, there's an expectation that we should be giving propositional form or something. But at least at the point of imaginary, there's something right there. Jacques Maritain talks about, you know, every generation needing to rethink what it means to do Christendom. Right? And by Christendom, it just means incarnating Christian practice. So, right? Anyway, yes, because we're all over the place all the time. We do potter at things.
Well, I was just thinking about, so I was complaining, I was ranting at Sarah about what we were going to talk about today. And I was saying, you know, there's this underlying assumption that politics is just, you know, this Machiavellian art of the possible. I think the art of the possible is Bismarck talked about politics as the art of the possible. And so it's all about just pragmatically doing whatever you can to get your understanding of the right thing to happen to happen. And then, but Sarah's like, but why would anyone think otherwise? Like, because that's how they're trained to think by their politicians, because that's how, in effect, politicians act. They act as if that's the vision of politics. And then I was like, well, actually, I suppose the answer there is at the center of an education for a liberal democratic country needs to be some sort of account given of what is politics for, what is this thing called democracy. And from my money, I don't think I ever received that as a...
Or even that that's on the table.
Yeah.
You know, that it's on the table that we are engaged in a noisy argument over what it is to do life together.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Sorry again for a couple
Not
of weeks
hugging
off.
Me. When the All Blacks lost.
Please like us on Facebook. You can find us by searching for The Eucatastrophe on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at UCAT, that's EUCAT _ podcast, and follow us there. And also share us around, recommend us to friends, that will really help us. Drop us a review. But please stop it with this men's rights thing. I'm starting to get recommended pages around like hashtag defamed too. And Alienated Fathers Network.
David, it really is hard when a mirror of self-examination is raised before you.
Yes, but listen, I appreciate the very funny reviews that are being left.
But, Rise of the Skywalker is coming out, people, and Dave's going to have some interesting things to say about Rey.
Please, cheer us around, and we'll meet you back here. Next week, as we talk about friendship and civil disagreement. See you then.